well. It depends on the demographic.
Excuse me.
I killed Baker.
Well, it's a dream. I mean, it could mean something else. It could mean I'm supposed to think you did.
No. I killed the enemy. I didn't know them either, so it was okay. Anyway, I remember what we did in Kuwait. I remember it perfectly. I just don't remember actually doing it.
Maybe you didn't do it.
No.
What a thought.
So bizarre, isn't it?
Which part?
I don't know what you saw downstairs. This campaign, politics, my whole public life and persona. Imposing and grinning like a goddamn sock puppet. Shaking hands with total strangers and must be completely blind if they can't see what I am at the core. But my mother has made me apprentice. Ferociously apprentice. But not a show, no, sir.
I see.
No, you don't. You can't. I was 20 years old before I had a friend. Worse, a girlfriend. Well, you know, from my point of view anyway. A friend outside of my mother's circle of approved encounters. And she... my mother... God only knows what she told Jocelyn to chase her away. Precipitating my sole act of rebellion, storming off and enlisting in the army. But after the war, I came back to her.
Why'd you come back? What happened?
Aren't you listening? Mother happened. You know, the truth is I hate it. I've always despised the middle. The cloying adulation of the little people. Certainly, nothing for you to be jealous of, Major.
I'm not jealous.
I don't have the dreams, Ben.
How could you not remember saving our unit?
I do. I said I did.
No, no, you didn't. You said that you didn't remember doing it. That's what you just said a couple minutes ago.
When I think about that night, it's as if I know what will happen. The thing is, I never seem to get to the point where I feel that it actually does happen. But I'm sure that's perfectly normal.
Okay, well, have you discussed this with anyone, these discrepancies?
Who would I share that with? My old army buddies who love and adore me for saving their pathetically unimportant present company excluded asses.
You could discuss it with army intelligence. You could go down there. I mean, I could go with you and discuss it, and you could tell them what you remember, what you don't remember, and they could run some tests. And...
yeah, tests. Press on the field day with that.
Somebody put an implant inside me. I found it this morning. I got the hole in my back, if you want to take a look at it. And I got a good feeling they put one in you, too.
Nobody's put anything in me, Ben.
Let's prove it. Why don't, you know, we'll go get an X-ray.
Okay. I want to be supportive of you. I do. But don't you think this could wait till after the election?
Why? For what? For what? What are you scared of?
I'm not afraid of anything.
Then why don't we just prove it when we can
find
out?
I think you should leave. I'm sorry. I really think...
Listen. Somebody got into our heads with big steel-toed boots, cable cutters and a chainsaw, and they went to town. Neurons got exposed, and circuits got rewired. Our brain cells got obliterated, Raymond. Please.
You need to get
help, Ben.
Himmler's guinea pigs. Heinrich Himmler, Lebensborn's program may have been the grandparent of Project Monarch. Monarch sought to create junior Manchurian candidates with multiple personalities, each trained to perform a specific specialty. The kids were programmed to respond to codes, mnemonic cues, audio reverse triggers, and tones. They were trained in killing techniques and the rapid assembly and deassembly of exotic weapons. They were educated about poisons, explosives, languages, and computers, then programmed to forget it all or remember only selected areas upon command. Monarch produced a cadre of child spies who were directed to prey upon high-placed military government and high-society pedophiles, sometimes hauling them into blackmail situations. As in the Nazi Lebensborn program, there is evidence of selected breeding, adoption of the children, and a peculiarly large number of twins among them. There is mounting evidence that the directors of Project Monarch were former Nazis and that, like Nazism, the Monarch program was interlaced with Satanism. Did this pet project of Heinrich Himmler rear its head 50 years after the demise of the Third Reich in the cornfields of Nebraska? While the last gavel has yet to fall in the ongoing litigation, and the major vein of the criminal conspiracy has yet to be opened up in court, it appears that Himmler's dream would come home to roost on the Great Plains in the good old USA. John DeCamp was a Nebraska state senator for 16 years, during which time he was one of the most effective legislators in Nebraska history. A highly decorated Vietnam War veteran, a practicing lawyer, he's taken time from his demanding practice to write a book, self-publish it, and sell it at lectures around the country. The Franklin cover-up, child abuse, Satanism, and murder in Nebraska is a no-holds-barred exegesis of Omaha, Nebraska's Franklin Community Federal Credit Union, which was raided by federal agents in November 1988. The raid sent shockwaves all the way up to Washington when it was learned that $40 million was missing. The credit union's manager was Republican Party activist Lawrence E. Larry King Jr. Behind him stood George Bush and other powerful figures in local politics and businesses and in the nation's capital. DeCamp used public records to tell the story. In face of opposition from local and state law enforcement, from the FBI and powerful Omaha World Herald newspaper, a special Franklin committee of the Nebraska legislature launched its own probe. What at first looked like just another savings and loan swindle soon exploded into a tale of drugs, Iran-Contra money laundering, a nationwide child abuse ring, and ritual murder, DeCamp said. The Franklin cover-up followed the ugly precedent of the Warren Commission. On June 21, 1991, 21-year-old Alicia John Owen was pronounced guilty by a jury in Douglas County, Nebraska, on 8 counts of felony perjury. On August 8, 1991, she was sentenced to serve him to 9 to 27 years in prison. Owen was indicted for telling a grand jury, before which he testified in 1990 that she was sexually abused as a juvenile by a Nebraska District Court judge, by the chief of police of the city of Oklahoma, the manager of the Franklin Community Federal Credit Union, and others. Alicia Owen also witnessed, she said, the abuse of other children by figures in Nebraska's political and financial establishment, whom she named, among them the publisher of the state's largest newspaper, the Omaha World Herald. She testified that she was in a group of Nebraska's children who functioned for years as illegal drug couriers, traveling nationwide for some of Nebraska's wealthiest, most powerful, and prominent businessmen. If King was involved with CIA money laundering, DeCamp wrote, that jives with a report from a member of Concerned Parents. I heard from two different black people in North Omaha that King used to stand limousines down to Outfit Air Base, home of the Strategic Air Command, to pick up CIA personnel for parties. The sometimes expansive Larry King used to talk fondly about his friends. In a September 17, 1988 interview with Metropolitan, King said, I know some of the people I admire aren't very popular. Ed Meese, the late Bill Casey of the CIA, and I love former Chief Justice Burger. Those are the people I really like to talk to. Bill Casey, I just so thought very highly of him. Larry King adorned Bill Casey, DeCamp said. But what about one of Casey's predecessors at Central Intelligence, George Bush? Ever since July 23, 1989, when the lead editorial in the World Herald said that one child is said to believe that she saw George Bush at one of King's parties. King's connection with Bush has been a frequently asked question about the Franklin case. Anxiety on this account has run especially high in Omaha's black community, where in December 1990, one young lady stood up at the public meeting and proclaimed, I think George Bush is involved in this child abuse case, and that is why all these people have been dying. Inside investigators of Franklin, and the Webb case before it, know that Bush's name came up at the very beginning, and it came up more than once. The July 1989 World Herald column, in an attempt to discredit this and other victim witness testimony, attributed the mention of Bush to a person, quote, under psychiatric care, meaning Loretta Smith. In reality, the report was from Nellie Patterson Webb. Nellie first brought up Bush in 1986, DeCamp said, when flown Julie Walters about the sex parties she was flown to in Washington and Chicago. She saw Bush at two of these parties, she said, one in each city. Bush's name surfaced again in Lowell's May 1989 review of reports of Thomas Flauelaus from the State Attorney General's office. Sorensen told Flauelaus that both Kimberly and Nellie brought up the name George Bush and indicated that they had both met him. On June 10, 1989, Lowe received a letter from a citizen. There is a psychologist in Omaha who used to work for CIA. In response to a direct question by Obama psychiatrist regarding George Bush's private life, this psychologist reported hearing rumors when Bush had head of the CIA that corrupted directly and corresponded directly with one of the inferences made by Nellie Webb. And, in August 1990, DeCamp said, Bush appointed Ronald Roskins of Nebraska to head the Agency for International Development, AID. Roskins has been fired from the previous year as Chancellor of the University of Nebraska, where Larry King was a member of his Chancellor's Advisory Committee. Gary Candori's daily notes from February 19, 1989, read, I was informed that Roskins was terminated by the state because of sexual activities reported to the regents and verified by them. Mr. Roskins was reported to have had young Matt in his residence for sexual encounters. As part of the separation from the state, he had to move out of the state-owned house because of the liability to the state, if some of this sexual behavior was illegal. Upon Roskins vacationing the house, he was provided a house by Joe Secrecy of the Lincoln Journal-Star. The leadership of AID is the kind of sensitive job AID assignments have been used as cover by CIA agents. For instance, for which a pointless undergo background check that would have to return up what Kadori had also heard. Nevertheless, George Bush appointed Roskins. What do Ronald Reagan, President George Bush, former CIA Director William Colby, Democratic presidential candidate Bob Kerry, billionaire and second richest man in America and now head of Salomon Brothers, Warren Buffett, and Ronald Roskins, the current administrator of the Agency for International Development, all have in common. I asked my close friend and advisor William Colby, DeCamp wrote. I give up, former head of Central Intelligence Agency, Colby said. What could that group have in common? Three things, I replied. All of them a burden at times for those who have to carry them out. The three things are me, John DeCamp, and Case Franklin, and a man named Larry King. Are you serious? Colby asked. Dead serious, I responded, and I hope that word dead does not turn out to be a prophetic pronouncement, as it has for at least 15 other Franklin-related personalities. My statement to Bill Colby was not made lightly, DeCamp said. Colby and his wife, Sally Shelton Colby, a United States ambassador under President Jimmy Carter, were the very moment warning me to get away from the Franklin child abuse case investigation. Larry King and anybody else linked with Franklin as quickly as possible for the sake of my own life and safety. Sally and Bill had never talked to me like this before. They sat me down, made it clear that this was not one of their routine discussions about life and health and happiness, and emphasized to me the serious nature of what I and who I'm dealing with. What you have to understand, John, is that sometimes these are forces and events too big, too powerful, with so much at stake for other people or in institutions that you cannot do anything about them, no matter how evil or wrong they are, and no matter how dedicated or sincere you are, or how much evidence you have. That is simply one of the hard facts of life you have to face. You have done your part. You have tried to expose the evil and wrongdoing. It has hurt you terribly, but it has not killed you to this point. I'm telling you, get out of this before it does. Sometimes things are just too big for us to deal with, and we have to step aside and let history take its course. For you, John, this is one of those times, Bill warned, with Sally nodding her head in an affirmation. When a caution of this nature comes from someone of the stature and experience of Bill or Sally or Colby, you have to take it seriously, even if you do not want to. I had already had warnings enough that unless I backed off from the Franklin situation, I might be looking at life from a pine box 6 feet underground. John DeCamp couldn't see how he could just lay down the issue and walk away from it. He couldn't see how anybody would want to live in a country where children were being sexually abused and killed by the nation's most respected citizens and business leaders who were also involved in drug dealing and official corruption. Every bone in my body tells me that evil is triumphing, and everybody who is anybody is scared being less to do anything about it for fear one thing or another, DeCamp said. If I or someone like me did not keep pursuing this, then who will? And if we quit now, then when, if ever, will the truth come out and something be done about the evil in this corruption? So DeCamp kept on keeping on. He is a capable attorney and a fearless man who was largely instrumental in bringing the eyes of the world to focus on Larry King and the Lincoln Savings and Loan Cabal. He gathered the evidence that brought the criminal conspiracy before two grand juries. Without knowing it, he stepped right in the middle of Project Monarch operation. Happily, he's still with us. Here's what happened in his own words. Quote, two grand juries, one local and one federal, had a mandate to consider these and other charges of child abuse connected with the Franklin Credit Union. They indicted the victim witness for perjury instead. This is unprecedented, probably in the history of the United States, commented Dr. Judian Dentzgerber, a lawyer, psychiatrist, and nationally prominent specialist on child abuse. Denson Gerber is an MD who is thought to be a CIA asset. Her husband was on the Warren Commission. During her visit to Nebraska in December 1990, she said, if the children are not telling the truth, particularly if they have been abused, they need to help medical attention. You don't throw them in jail. Both grand juries, DeCamp continued, admitted that Alicia Owen and Paul Bonacci, whose testimony extensively corroborate Owen's, had been badly abused. But this was done, they concluded, by persons other than those young people named. Bonacci, too, was indicted for perjury. Two other victim witnesses, whose stories buttressed those of Owen and Bonacci, recanted under immense pressure. Alicia Owen and Paul Bonacci refused to recant. This was the first time the tip of the Monarch iceberg surfaced in a public It is a story which matched with others in all its lurid details, perverted sexuality, bestiality, ritual abuse, trauma, and mind control. In late 1993, a key Franklin SNL witness, Troy Lawner, admitted that the Federal Bureau of Investigation terrorized and forced him to lie for the protection of criminal perpetrators. Bonner's coerced testimony was used to discredit the case against the powerful political figures and to falsely convict for perjury Alicia Owen. Attorney John DeCamp filed for a new trial for Ms. Owen. He also pressed an extensive explosive civil rights suit on behalf of Paul Bonacci, who continued to give evidence against armed forces and intelligence community personnel and political leaders, including former President George Bush. The existence of Troy Bonner's sworn statement and the application for a new trial for Alicia Owen were covered in a small detail poor article October 30, 1993 in the Omaha World Herald, a newspaper which is central party in the Franklin case. Otherwise, aside from a November 1, 1993, Omaha radio interview with Bonner and his attorney DeCamp, the new evidence was subjected to a tight press blackout. After the Nebraska State Senate Investigating Committee found that over 100 children could testify to an international child abuse ring related to Black Republican Party activist Larry King, Franklin's chief executive, the FBI, and Nebraska officials, and the news media attacked the legislative committee and its witnesses in an atmosphere of rising violence and intimidation. In the course of this terror, the committee's chief investigator, Gary Cardori, was killed when his airplane unexplainably disintegrated. Troy Bonner's brother was found shot to death at Outfoot Air Force Base. Alicia Owen's brother was found hung in jail. In a separate October 27, 1993 affidavit, Troy Bonner's mother said, "Troy had promised me right after Gary Cardori was killed that he was going to quit lying for the FBI and attorney Mark DeMond. He did go on to see Senator Schmidt, sometimes after that, my son. Troy's brother, Sean, was killed, and I'm quite certain was executed as a message to Troy that he had been better stick with the lies in upcoming Alicia Owen trial or else." In his affidavit, Troy Bonner said that after Cardori's death, he spoke to Cardori's widow. "Sandy told her I, in fact, lied to the grand jury, and that what I told Gary Cardori was the truth, and that I only lied out of fear that the FBI and others would hurt me or my family." In November 1, 1993, KKAR radio interview, Troy Bonner claimed that he had also met with Omaha World Herald reporter Gabriella Stern out of fear for his life. He had sought the reporter's protection so he could do what was right by Cardori, to whom he had told the truth. He said he asked her to get the story out, but not to use his name. He was then 23 years old. The World Herald, in fact, had carried out an article on July 12, 1990, by Robert Dorr and Gabrielle Stern, headlined, "Cardori's airplane broke up in mid-flight." The article quoted State Senator Lorraine Schmidt saying the two people wanted to see Cardori dead got their wish, and that Schmidt told AP that Cardori recently had been trying to obtain pictures that some alleged victims said were taken of them during the time they were abused. The article further including the following three paragraphs. A 23-year-old man whose last November gave Cardori's a videotaped statement saying he had been sexually abused but later recanted part of his account said that investigator deaths frightened him. He said Cardori had warned him that people involved in the Franklin investigation could be in danger. The 23-year-old man, who hasn't been publicly identified, said he fears someone who might try to harm him. The 23-year-old, who said he had flown with Cardori several times during the investigation, said the investigator was meticulous about checking the plane before taking off. DeCamp filed suit in the United States court in Nebraska on behalf of Paul Bonacci, the courageous survivor of nearly two decades of torture. The suit asked damages from the Catholic Diocese of Omaha relating to exclusively to sex abuse at the Boys Town Orphanage, Lawrence King, Peter Citron, Alan Bearer, Harold Anderson, and Robert Wadman for sex crimes, slavery, beating, and burnings. Omaha police officers for harassment in an attempt to prevent Bonacci from testifying, and the corrupt Douglas County Grand Jury, its foreman Michael Flanagan, and its special prosecutor Samuel Van Pelt. During raids on Peter Citrone's home, police seized a large number of videotapes on which were recorded the degraded criminal acts committed by many elite citizens against Paul Bonacci, Alicia Owen, Troy Bonner, and others. These tapes were prized by the perpetrators as pornography and had great value as well as for blackmail. Paul Bonacci filed an affidavit detailing the individuals and the crimes on the tapes and asking for a release of the tapes to his attorney, John DeCamp. Although former World Herald Society columnist Peter Citrone had been classified as a mentally disordered sex offender, Citrone's attorney Lyle Koenig opposed the release of the tapes to the young man his client victimized. Because of the likelihood of injury to otherwise innocent people, there will be people in the state whose lives will be in a hopeless shambles as a result of these disclosures. Since the 1992 publication of DeCamp's book, Paul Bonacci has filed new affidavits and has given extensive interviews to investigators, including reporters for Executive Intelligence Review and the New Federalists. Bonacci's disclosures correlated with evidence supplied by authorities in law enforcement, psychiatry, and the intelligence community. The results go a long way to explain the high stakes involved and a frantic nature of the Franklin cover-up. The tight little circle of Nebraska corporate and financial interests, wrote Anton Chatkin, intertwined with the Franklin Credit Union, defines the first level of national power that is threatened with exposure in a case. A clique of Freemasons, the chief executive of the Union Pacific Railroad, ConAgra, Peter Kiewit and Sons, Mutual of Omaha, and the Omaha World Herald served as Franklin's advisory board and conduit funds from their own firms and from the Boys Town Orphanage into Franklin's accounts. Union Pacific boss Michael Walsh, for example, was chairman of finance for Boys Town. The Union Pacific headquarters offices in Omaha is reportedly completely gripped by homosexuality at the executive level. Chatkin pointed out that the foreman of the grand jury, which indicted the sex crimes victim Michael Flanagan, who himself employed in the legal department of Union Pacific, a company deeply involved in the Franklin case. The Bonacci suit charged that Flanagan violated his grand jury duties by sharing grand jury information with lawyers and others he met on a particular regular basis almost every day following grand jury proceedings at Union Pacific headquarters, receiving advice and guidance from them on how to proceed in the grand jury proceedings and providing them information on the supposedly secret grand jury proceedings themselves. Flanagan had, Chatkin wrote, not long prior to the grand jury sessions, himself been accused of homosexual pandering directed at a young Union Pacific employee, and the company, on his behalf, had reached a settlement to silence the complaining young man. In his October 28, 1993 affidavit, Paul Bonacci stated, "The real activity I and Alicia and on occasion Troy Bonner were engaged in was functioning as drug couriers and recruiters of children for Alan Barr and Larry King. They were buying and selling large quantities of cocaine into the Midwest and using us as mules to obtain the goods from the various airports and get the drugs delivered back to Omaha. Other prominent and wealthy Omaha citizens were also involved in this. The sex activities we did were paid so well for us, just tools to blackmail and compromise or pay off some judge or businessman or policeman or politicians generally here in Omaha or at Larry King's place in Washington or other places we went." Now in prison, Franklin Credit Union manager Larry King became infamous as the host of child sex parties held at the seats of power, such as Republican National Convention. DeCamp's book placed King in the middle of a national and international organized crime syndicate engaged in pedophilia, pornography, Satanism, drugs, and money laundering. Chetkin wrote, "The use of these crimes to blackmail or compromise or pay off powerful men leads to extremely serious questions of national security." Larry Kim's prime Nebraska sponsor and accused sex crime associate, former World Herald publisher Harold Anderson, was chairman of the World Press Freedom Committee, which Chaikin called a front for the Oliver North Project Democracy faction of the intelligence services managing political power relations with Eastern Europe. Harold Anderson's reported best friend in Washington, D.C. was Nebraskan Robert Keith Gray, a shadowy power broker at the hill of Knowlton political management firm. Over many years, Gray and his associates in the intelligence community are said to have managed homosexual compromising operations to keep congressmen, judges, military officers, diplomats, and foreign leaders in line, Jakin said. The Franklin Credit Union was, from all evidence, among the savings institutions used for money laundering by the CIA and others for Iran-Contra ventures. This precisely defines where, Jakin said, Omaha's Larry King showed up in Washington, D.C., in the bizarre homosexual wing of the Republican Party, which managed financing and public relations for the Iran-Contra guns for drugs trading games. Paul Bonacci described in detail being dragged to Washington for use as a sex toy for Larry King's clients. Bonacci told investigators he was one of the private White House tours for young male prostitutes conducted by lobbyist Craig Spence, a close political associate of Larry King, in the cloak and dagger at Contra and Surprise. Spencer turned up dead in a Boston hotel room in 1989, soon after his and King's compromising businesses were exposed in the Washington Times June 29, 1980 story, headlined, Homosexual Prostitution Inquiry Ensnares VIPs with Reagan Bush. In one instance detailed in the Franklin cover-up, Paul was taken by Larry King and others to a wooded area in California, identified after publication as the Bohemian Grove. There, Paul and other boys were forced to perform unusual sex acts with and to consume parts of a child whom they had watched being murdered by the cultists. The body was to be disposed of by the men with the hoods. A snuff pornography film was made of these events. It was directed by a man the party had picked up in Las Vegas, whom Paul identified as Hunter Thompson, the same name as well-known author. At Outfit, and later at other military installations, Bonacci said this ring programmed him through torture, heavy drugging, and sexual degradation, instructing him in military arts of assassination. Bonacci's personal knowledge of these realms, Chadkin said, can scarcely be accounted for other than by crediting the indictments he has made. Larry King, FBI agent Jerry Well, Alan Barr, Harold Anderson, and former Omaha Police Chief Robert Weidman have all been reported as collaborators with the satanic military-based ring. King reportedly told Pohl's captor at Outfit, "He's young, but you trained him good." A member of Nebraska's Concerned Parent Group reported hearings from the two North Omaha witnesses that King used to send limousines down to Outfit Air Base to pick up CIA agents for parties. Psychiatrists have treated several growing number of MPD cases. Victims of satanic ritual abuse report alarming pattern of findings in many of their child patients, Jetkin wrote. There's a structure to the personalities, conforming to what is evidently a deliberate breaking and reshaping of the mind. This phenomena was identified to Paul Bonacci by his tormentors and to other victims and witnesses as the Monarch Project. At Outfit Air Base, Bonacci was told that he and other children were being subjected to was in the interest of national security. The use of mind-altering drugs, sensory deprivation, and other brainwashing techniques on U.S. citizens as subjects was the admitted practice of the CIA. Certain military arms and private institutions joined in the MKUltra, Artichoke, and Blue Bear projects beginning in the early 1950s. A national security pretext often cited was the need to keep up with the Soviets in the race to develop a workable Manchurian candidate human robot, Jakin wrote. With the Monarch Project, the idea is extended to the production of a horde of children in whom the soul is crushed who would spy, whore, kill, and commit suicide. Professionals probing into the child victims of Monarch say there are clearly two responsible elements at work: the government, military, and cooperation of satanic and or explicitly pagan cults. These are multi-generational groups where parents donate their own children who are proudly called bloodline or simply blood cultists to be smashed with drugs and electric shock and shaped, Jakin wrote. Other children are kidnapped and sold into this hell or are brought in gradually through daycare situations. Paul Bonacci and other child victims have given evidence in great depth and the central role of Lieutenant Colonel Michael Aquino in this depravity, Chaitkin wrote. Aquino, alleged to have recently retired from an active military role, was long the leader of an Army psychological warfare section which drew on his expertise and personal practices in brainwashing, Satanism, Nazism, homosexual pedophilia, and murder. A former director of the CIA, one assumes that this was William Colby, was asked directly, "What about Monarch?" He replied angrily and ambiguously, "We stopped that between the late 1960s and early 1970s. If a statement of fact, this would presumably relate to official participation of the CIA," Chaitkin said. The disclosures of Paul Bonacci, which jive with reports of MPD professionals in other cases, point to several peculiar artificially induced memories common to so many Monarch victimized children. Chaitkin said that a number of the victims were recovering memories of tormentors dressed as space aliens or Mickey Mouse or in Wizard of Oz costumes. They are said to be such other personality levels as Master Programmer, Black Master, and different mental levels of backup programs, Chaitkin said. They are reported to be personnel who give large numbers of child victims assignments and triggers neatly filed in their little computers. Paul Bonacci reported the following Monarch-related activities, often involving his commander at Outfit Air Force Base, Bill Plemons, and Lieutenant Colonel Michael Aquino. Picking up cash in exchange for drugs or various Tennessee locations, identifying several country music personalities and his contacts. Trips on behalf of the North American Man-Boy Love Association, NAMBLA, the pedophile group now given semi-official status by the United Nations. Bonacci cited travel in the Netherlands and Germany carrying child pornography or subsequent import to the USA to avoid prosecution. In Amsterdam, he named Charles Hester as the British Tommy Carter, who had on a computer a global list of child pornography users. NAMBLA, who also cited for organizing auctions of children. Travel to Hawaii, New York, Washington, in connection with Craig Spence to compromise public figures by performing homosexual pedophile sex with them. The trip to California, where the boys was ritually murdered, accompanied by Monarch contact Mark Johnson of Denver, Colorado. Travel to Mexico for the transportation of drugs, guns, and children. Paul was accompanied by the gangster figure Emilio, who otherwise directed the kidnapping of Johnny Gosch of Des Moines, Iowa. Johnny Gosch's parents commend Paul Bonacci as an accurate witness relative to that crime. Training under Captain Foster, survival skills at Fort Riley, Kansas, under Lieutenant Dave Bannister, intelligence at Fort Bragg, North Carolina, under Colonel Harris Livick at Fort Defiance, Virginia, who is said to run a military school and have housed Monarch boys. Colonel Bill Risher of Bamberg, South Carolina, is said to have supplied children for Michael Aquino. Traveled to Dresden in communist East Germany, where weapons were inspected, there is an a Federal Republic of Germany, the Monarch personnel who frequently neo-Nazis. This area, Bonacci said, was a special project of Lieutenant Colonel Aquino, who was a West European advisor to the U.S. Chiefs of Staff. Bonacci had extensive experience in the Aryan Nation and other white supremacist cults. Bonacci told the story of the teenage concentration camp inmate allegedly named Greenbaum, who had participated with the Nazis to save himself, came to the United States under Project Paperclip, the secret intelligence illegal importation of Nazi war criminals by the U.S. intelligence agencies, known later as Dr. Green. Bonacci said he'd become a high-level mind controller and, according to Bonacci, is widely represented today in mind control programs which have a distinctive magic theme. Precise details of all these horrors lie deeply buried in national security archives, perhaps. But this history, as told to psychiatrists, dovetails with what is definitively known about Anglo-American intelligence operations and the German Nazis. The killers in the Nazi camps were themselves trained and organized by psychiatrists, eugenicists operating from the T4 Bureau. These psychiatrists had long been the pets of white supremacist British and American financial networks. At least some of these Nazi doctors were spirited out of Germany under the supervision of former Bank of England Governor Montague Norman and Tavistock Institute Director John R. Rees on behalf of the British government, Chaitkin wrote. Norman had been chief of pre-war pro-Nazi faction within England, and Rees organized post-war propaganda, continuing psychological warfare activities, and created Orwellian groupings within U.S. psychiatry and mental health fields. Much of this criminal history comes together in the persons of Robert A. Lovett. Robert Lovett and his closest associates have run the state of Nebraska during much of this century. Lovett was the chief executive of the Harriman-owned and Omaha-based Union Pacific Railroad, as his father had been. Robert Lovett was a partner in the Brown Brothers Harriman International Banking Firm with Avril Harriman and Prescott Bush, father of President George Bush, Chaitkin wrote. Montag Norman arranged many of the intrigues on behalf of Hitler and the Nazi Party through Harriman, Lovett, Bush firm, in which Norman himself had been a hereditary partner. Under President Truman, Robert Lovett declared the Lovett Committee, which made the decision that the U.S. should have a central intelligence agency modeled on the British Intelligence Service. Lovett was Secretary of Defense in 1951 to 53. His attorney, Alan Dulles, then took over the CIA. Lovett, Harriman, the Bush family, and a very select group of their associates, owners of drug and defense multinationals, many from Yale's Skull and Bones Society, maintained homes on Jupiter Island off Hope Sound north of Palm Beach, Florida. Jupiter Island is the headquarters for the so-called utopian faction in military strategy, the heavy Anglophiles, as opposed to the traditional typified by Douglas MacArthur, Chaitkin wrote. Troy Bonner, a witness in the Franklin Credit Union case, swore out a new affidavit on October 27, 1993, and in the affidavit, Bonner said, "I, my mother, and my family are exhausted from living in fear of death or injury as a result of the Franklin matters. I lied at the grand jury hearings and I lied at the Alicia Owen trial. I lied because I truly believed and still do believe that it was a situation where I must either lie or die. And the instance primarily of the Federal Bureau of Investigation officials, Mr. Mickey Mott and Mr. Rick Culver, what I told Gary Cordori in the original taped interviews. In my first contact with the FBI, they made it clear to me that they were only interested in disproving everything I had told them. They took the position that if you will tell us you are lying, then we'll let you off the hook, but if you insist on sticking with the story you told Caldari, then we will stick it to you in prison for 20 years, each on a lot of different charges of perjury. If you insist on sticking with your story, you will go down. The FBI, in conjunction with my new attorney, Mark Delman, made me say that. The truth was a lie, and the lies they wanted to tell me were the truth. I told the grand jury what the FBI and Delman wanted me to tell the grand jury, which is what the story to Gary Cordori was, a hoax. But, as stated, the exact opposite is true. Then, Gary Cordori was killed. I have no proof, but since I believed he was deliberately killed as part of a cover-up and as a result of lies to the grand jury, I immediately called his home and spoke to his wife, Sandy, told her that what I had told Gary was the truth and that I only lied to the grand jury out of fear of the FBI and others, and they would hurt me or my family and promised they would put me in jail if I did not do what they say. I also met Senator Bernadette Leibitz at the Cordori funeral and agreed I would meet her and Senator Schmidt for lunch immediately following the funeral, going over my alleged recantation and tell her and the committee all the facts. At the funeral, however, FBI agents made it clear to me through their actions that they knew what I was up to and gave me the clear impression that I was in great danger if I went ahead and met with the legislative committee and tried to tell them the truth. So I told my mother that I was going to stick with my lies to the grand jury. Later, Mark Delman and Mickey Mott sought Senator Schmidt say on TV that I had been in his Schmidt's office and my recantation had been false. Even though Mark Delman knew I had been at Schmidt's office and that what he had Schmidt was saying was the truth, he asked me whether the conversation had been taped or whether there was any record of my having been in Schmidt's office to talk to Schmidt. I told Delman there was no tape or any other record. On Delman's instructions, I publicly lied and denied any meeting or discussion with Senator Schmidt and Delman. Delman's exact words to me were, "It's your word against his as long as there are no tapes." Mickey Mott, the FBI man, then said something I interpreted to have been a direct and personal threat that later came to pass. When I told the FBI people that Alan Bear and others could not afford to do anything to hurt me now because too much publicity was focused on me, Mott told me that they probably would not do anything directly to me, that instead they will do something to a family member. And that is what happened shortly thereafter, when the FBI and Barr and others thought I might break away from them. I'm certainly certain that my brother Sean was killed as a message to me not to tell the truth at the Lisa Owen trial. After Sean got killed, I had no doubt at all that they would do anything and kill anybody to keep the truth contained and to keep me lying for them, and I complied with their every request. Before the Alicia Owen trial, I was carefully rehearsed by the FBI as what I would say. The FBI had actual pictures in their possession, including Alan Bear, a 1983 picture of he and me at age 15 or 16 in very pornographic sexual acts, as well as checks from Alan Bear to me. So they had to absolutely know I had a relationship with him, and they were forcing me to lie when they denied such relationships in court. The FBI seized photos and tapes involving, among others, and myself, Larry King. I know from having seen the tapes at Peter Citron's house that the FBI had access to tapes which clearly documented what had other kids I had identified. I know the FBI and others will say in reply, "You can't believe Troy Bonner now. If he lied once, he'll lie again. He's a drug addict. He's a sex pervert. Besides, these kids were used the drugs, selling their bodies, getting paid well for it, and they did it all voluntarily." Yes, we kids from early age sold our bodies. We became drug addicts. We got lots and lots of money from these people, but today we are ruined because of that, and we were turned into sex perverts and drug addicts by these people. Alan Barr was one of the first taught me to mainline who he was first, inject heroin directly into my veins, same as he did a lot of other boys. He made a prisoner of drug addiction too, completely control me and use me to deliver drugs or deliver sex or anything else. Alan Bear first injected me with speedball, heroin, cocaine mix that zips you up but brings you down mellow. Mark Delman claimed that I had not met with Senator Schmidt to tell the truth, and I followed his instructions in denying it. This can be checked out. There are people who saw me with Schmidt and Senator Libetz. And I saw the picture the FBI had of me and Alan Bear. Some official sure ought to be able to get the picture to prove who was lying, me or the FBI. Lots of kids knew about Alan Bear, Larry King, and the major drug dealing activity they and other prominent people were involved in. But as long as they are scared for their lives because of what happened to Alicia and me, they are not going to say anything. An honest prosecutor should step in and offer immunity and protection to these kids. Ask me or any other kids to take a lie detector test side by side on the same question with the people we're accusing of these things. Research writer, producer Andy Bohm interviewed Paul Bonacci with DeCamp's assistant Denise Meyer in 1993. He corroborates the stories of other Project Monarch victims. Please note that Bohm, as well as Chaykin, questions whether Monarch is the true code name of the project. Paul Bonacci encountered Michael Aquino at Outfoot Air Force Base several times wearing an Army uniform. Manley was on his trips to, I think it was St. Louis, Bonacci said. And because he came here for a couple of different satanic holidays, Bonacci said, Aquino and other members of the Temple of Set dedicated a part of the old market in downtown Street Louis to Satan, walking around the area in street clothes performing the ritual. I encountered a lot of things that were the Monarch that were somewhere else, Bonacci said. We went to different military bases. I went to Fort Riley, Kansas. I went to Presidio out in California for some training, a base in Colorado, which is where they said a lot of the alien training took place. What they would do is have a couple of ships that would look like alien ships, and they'd drug you up. Because I remember doing this to other kids, and they'd use some of the other kids that they would put them in uniforms, and they would use LSD, which would make you feel like you were already out of it anyway. They would be wearing uniforms and they would do little experiments. They would actually take little metal, they looked like implants, and they would let you see what you were doing. Some people would implant them and then take them out. Later on, I know some of them were locators because they wanted to know where the person was at all times. I mean, they had this little thing. It was on the satellite and they could find that person. The reason they were doing it, I overheard some of them talking about it. This sounds weird, as they had soldiers in action in something countries, and they would know where all their men were and would know what they were doing and what the status was, whether they were living or dead, or if they would be able, if they were dead, to find their body. So that's why they were testing them, but on the kids, they were using it to make sure they knew where they were. Bohm said to Bonacci, "So aside from Aquino, did you see some, wherever you were, with these monarch activities, did you see some of the people, the two, who were at the satanic activities as well?" "Some of them, yes," Bonacci said. "The adults were wearing military uniforms when they were training us, and so were we. They kept everything at the base, but during most of the training, we wore regular street clothes. When we went through the alien program, we wore our street clothes. The reason that anybody could come out of Monarch alive was because they all would be talking about little green men." Giving some insight into the difficulties of all Monarch victims have, Bonacci said, "I remember when I first started talking, everything was so jumbled up and then there was their programming. Because people would try and get information out of me and the codes that they would use to scramble everything was very same for the same people asking me. They were asking me a question, but they were doing something to get everything scrambled up." When Bohm asked Bonacci where he got the name Monarch, the young man said, "I got the name Monarch because Monarch was the name that was part of a code that was supposed to destroy all my memories of Monarch activities." Another more fully recovered Monarch victim says that she doubts if Bonacci ever heard the word Monarch. Bonacci explained that when the word Monarch was heard, it was almost started to erase everything I knew. But that must not have been the entire code, just the name, because it would trigger enough of his sick personalities so they'd start coming out in random order telling everything. They thought this was deprogramming time, so it's time to start telling everything. But then Bonacci said the programmers weren't there to pull them into the personalities out one at a time, so it's like each of them come out, as you know, in different orders. Bonacci said there was two groups of Project Monarch slaves. Some were put into society, Bonacci said. They were the ones that went into entertainment, and a lot of them were used for transporting drugs, which is why they were paid for the programming. They used the entertainment industry because they could input their messages for the future. If they wanted to start a revolution, Bonacci said, they'd put it right in the music and it would go out over the airwaves. It was not easy for Paul Bonacci to remember certain things. At the time of Bohm's interview with him, he was still in intensive therapy and had not completely reintegrated his multiple personalities. Bohm asked how they went about planting things in his mind, things which he said he would make him sound absurd if he told anyone about them. They would play things, show things on screen, Bonacci said. They would have that person sitting there and saying something, but you couldn't really tell what he was saying. Yet you'd hear the words real plain, but it might not take to make him sound like his voice. Like he was talking, you could see that he was talking, but the words in the mouth didn't match. But you would put it together, like an actor speaking in a poorly dubbed foreign film. Bonacci said one part of the training was trying to get him to read other people's minds. Everybody says I basically read their mind. They'd ask, and I'd answer it them before they got it out. The ones they used for that extrasensory perception were the ones they trained in Satanism. They trained them as magicians because this is going on to sound even crazier. When they trained us, we could actually do it because there are spiritual forces and they do teach you to control how to get demons to do stuff for you. I can't say control because those demons are going to turn on you someday, but having your own demons that would do it. They would be the ones that would do it. So, Bohm said, you were instructed in that sort of context, now that there was a physical force from yourself, Bonacci said. But it's acted like a little spiritual, Bohm said. It's spiritual rather than scientific. Yes. Was it always on the negative side, Bohm asked? Was it a demon rather than a god or angel or a fairy? It was always on the demonic side, Bonacci said, because that's the only ones that you could work with. If somebody asked you, you never told them about the demonic stuff. It was always, you're in control, you can do it. Bonacci went on to describe what sounded like a bad acid trip. I was able to do a lot of things, such as, at the time, which I can't do now because I don't have demons under my control. I don't want them. But turning on TVs, turning off lights, blowing things up, like light bulbs or something, we could make tires go flat on people's cars, and we can make them so they can start. This is stuff that I did after I was away from them. So far, it sounds like there's an army of zombies being trained from a very early age in Satanism, magic, and certain skills of psychoscience. This was surprising enough, but it was infuriating to hear that at a very early age, Bonacci was trained to hate black people. They trained me to hate black people, Bonacci said. The Aryan Nations did, Bohm asked. No, the government program. That's why I didn't like Larry King at all. I mean, it was kind of like, to me, I hated him from the time I met him. Andy Bohm said, Paul says a lot of outlandish things, but despite initial doubts, I now believe that everything he told me is either true or he sincerely believes it is true. I've seen people like former FBI bigwig Ted Gundersen's try to lead him into lying and try to test his tales with uncaptioned photos. Paul never comes out having uttered an intentional falsehood. CBS lambasted him for having said that the years earlier had seen now the Omaha mayor P.J. Morgan engaging in sex with little boys, or more accurately said they were told he was J.P. Morgan. The mayor heatedly denies this is a CBS special about innocent folks wrongly accused of child abuse, Bohm said. Had CBS bothered to look more deeply into the case, they'd have noted that Mayor P.J. Morgan used to have a son named P.J. Morgan Jr. They say he used to have a son because Morgan Jr., a well-known Omaha pederast, killed himself the day after the kiddie sex aspects of the Franklin scandal became public. Right name, right family, wrong guy, or maybe not. Some say the mayor himself was in some usual appetites. Bonacci said his monarch programming started when he was 5 and continues until he was 22. Most of the people that they trained were probably fairly young, probably 4 or 5, up until the time they were out of high school, because as soon as you're out of high school, they either plan for you to go into the military, or, as one advised, take Bonacci's testimony as that of a non-integrated MPI. Guilt trip laid on survivors' behalf system that places the blame for a mind control victim's behavior on themselves is not helpful. One should not be asked to identify with one's own behavior unless one has made free choice of that behavior. Apparently, the U.S. legal system would not agree, such as the legal and judicious ignorance of the capability of mind control. Following up. Veteran mind control researcher Kathy Castern posted on the following article from the Des Moines Register on February 2, 1999 on the web. Mind control victim awarded $1 million. U.S. government mind control programs like MKUltra and Monarch, directed against helpless victims, human guinea pigs, have been virtually ignored by the big media cartel. On February 27, 1999, however, U.S. District Court Judge Urban found former Franklin SNL manager Lawrence King guilty of numerous crimes committed against mind control victim Paul Bonacci. King, serving a 15-year sentence for his role in the theft of the $40 million from Franklin and Omaha Credit Union, was ordered by Judge Urban to pay Bonacci $800,000 in compensatory damages and an additional $200,000 in punitive damages. This legal judgment against the notorious perpetrator of satanic ritual child abuse is unprecedented. In the memorandum of decision, Judge Urban wrote, King continually subjected the plaintiff, Bonacci, to repeated sexual assaults, false imprisonment, infliction of emotional extreme stress, organized and directed satanic rituals, forced the plaintiff to scavenge for children to be part of a defendant King's sexual abuse and pornography ring, forced the plaintiff to engage in numerous sexual contacts with the defendant King and others, and participate in deviant sexual games with masochistic orgies with other minor children. He, Bonacci, had suffered burns, broken fingers, beatings of the head and face, and other indignities by the wrongful actions of the defending king, the judge declared. In addition to the misery of going through experiences just related over a period of 8 years, the planet have suffered the lingering results of the present time. He, Bonacci, is a victim of multiple personality disorder, involving as many 14 distinct personalities aside from his primary personality, wrote the judge. He has given up a desire...